podcast series, devised and hosted by me, David Roth, and in collaboration with ANU, the Museum of the Jewish People, that's so much more than a museum. ANU is a unique global institution that helps bind the Jewish community by telling the ongoing, extraordinary and unique story of the Jewish people. In this special Passover broadcast series, I talk to our guests about their individual stories and who, from history or living today, they'd like to invite as their Passover Seder service guest. To find out more about this series, go to mysederguest.com, but not before you've listened to this. My guest in this edition of our podcast series is Arina Nevzalin. Arina, thanks very much indeed for joining me.
Hi, David, and thank you.
Arina is an Israeli entrepreneur, the chair of the board of directors at ANU, Museum of the Jewish People in Tel Aviv, president of the Nadav Foundation, founder and chair of Improvate, and the author of the award-winning book, The Impact of Identity, The Power of Knowing Who You Are. Born and educated in Moscow, Arina worked as a communication consultant in London and then emigrated to Israel in 2006. Arina was selected by the Jerusalem Post newspaper as one of the 50 most influential Jews in the world. And those are just some of her achievements. Arina, what is it that drives you?
David, thank you very much for the lengthy introduction. I'm sorry for the listeners. Look, I think what drives me is the fact that I'm Jewish. I think I don't know how to explain it better, but we were just talking with you about what happens in Israel and the empathy and care about the country and the people that I'm living in. And I think that being Jewish is a very kind of interesting petrol for passion and for meaning and for fulfillment. So I think that, honestly, it's very simple. It's the fact that I'm born Jewish is what drives me.
And what was your first realization of your Jewish heritage and identity as a child growing up in Moscow?
My process was a very long one. And it's funny, whenever I tell that story, you ask anyone who was born at the same time in Russia, they'll have a very similar story to that. So people born in the 70s in Soviet Union yet, and our parents were deprived from any knowledge of our heritage, of our roots, of our identity. It was, you know, homo sovieticus for everyone. There was no opportunity to be different, be ethnically or whatever way. So my first understanding that I'm different from others and that I'm mean something was at the age of 7, when I was told on the street that I am a Żydowka, which is a derogatory term for a Jew in Polish. That was the first time that somebody pointed out to the fact that I might be different from the rest. It's, I think, that point, and then coming to Israel at the age of 13, not knowing Jewish history and not knowing what Israel and Jerusalem is, I'm on a very, very long journey of discovering on what it means to be Jewish, what it means to be connected to your heritage. But I think the disability to explore it in the young age, as much as it is a disadvantage, I think it turned out to be my advantage because I was so eager to find out who I am that I think the journey became very worthwhile.
What were your first recollections of Passover, Arina?
As I said, I was born in a Jewish family where nothing was celebrated. The reason for that was that we were quite, I think my parents and my grandparents were quite afraid to celebrate anything. It was, you had to adhere, you know, to the Communist Party music, not to any religion or tradition. So I'm also not a person of a very good memory of the childhood. So my first recollection of Pesach Seder was already when I made Aliyah to Israel and started to do that with my family. I have a very colorful, complicated, and extended family. And a lot of us have never had an experience of Seder the way it is because nobody knew how to read the Megillah. You know, nobody knew what was expected. And so couple of first Passovers were fascinating because you could see these people which feel that this is something theirs. My family and four generations of my family feel that it's something theirs, don't always recognize the words, don't understand why it's so long, but feel some magic happening during those hours. And I like this feeling of this being, I think, the most important Jewish holiday, at least for me, the feeling of getting your freedom and getting the ability to be who you are back, taking it actually back. That still amazes me because we do Seder in many languages. We have people of many languages. We try to invite everyone who doesn't have a place. It grows and it grows. And it touches me every time, this ability to sit and remember what it took to be who we are, basically starting from my Aliyah to Israel.
What was your motivation for your Aliyah from London to Tel Aviv?
It's interesting that you ask me because I was thinking about that yesterday. I loved living in London. London feels like a home to me completely. And yet none of the places in the world are the same way home as Israel is. I remember myself telling, I was going on back and forth from London from work to for the weekends to be here in Israel with family and friends. And at some point, I remember saying to myself, I have to go home. So as much as London felt home, and I'm there every couple of months, and I love this place. I feel very much at home in London. But there is something so deep in the gut that makes Israel my home that I think eventually I just said it's time to go back.
You've successfully led the transformation of what was Beit HaTfitzot, an environment that hadn't really changed for decades, into a totally different experience across every single dimension, across every single element of your senses. What have you learned about change during that process?
Wow, that's a small question for a series of lectures. Look, I learned what we know, all of us, which is people... All of us, we don't like change in the very beginning. We resist it because we like the known. We want to believe that there is known. I've also learned that what can break this ice of not liking the change is having a vision, having something that people would want to change for. I've also learned that if you have a team of people that believe in this vision from the deep of their heart, not as work, but as shlichut, you can do almost anything. But you need to make sure that you have a vision which is easily explained, exciting enough, and long-term, and can influence 1,000 lives for better. So I think that's what I learned. And this is, by the way, if we talk a little about, it's difficult not to talk about what's happening in Israel now. One of the biggest problems, one of the biggest crises that we have currently now is not one of the sides, is not one of the judicial reform, is not one of that. It's the fact that country needs to choose its vision. And it needs to go towards something that people can subscribe to. And one of the problems is that we don't have a vision that unites us. Some of us don't have at all vision. But some of us don't. We don't have a vision that says, so, okay, we created this state of Israel. This is what we wanted it to be. Now where does it go? We are so happy and lucky that we have a country that we forgot that there came a moment to think where we should be taking it next. And I think for Jewish people, it doesn't work the way it works maybe in other places. You cannot take it easy. You cannot not take responsibility for your future. You cannot not put a goal and a vision. I think we're being punished for not deciding where, at least not coming together to decide where do we want the country to go.
I think that's very well said. And within that context then, as chair of ANU, do you feel a responsibility to the global Jewish community to tell the story of the Jewish people, to keep that always up to date?
Oh, absolutely. That's the reason I'm there. Look, I think that Jewish story is fascinating, amazing, huge, difficult, complicated, and it has all sorts of angles, right? And I think that it's very presumptuous to think that you can tell all the Jewish story, but I think that if we only we could make sure that anyone who comes to ANU, and I'm talking especially people from diaspora who have to fight more to keep their identity, who have to invest more energy to keep their Jewish identity, if they come to Israel and they come to ANU first and they feel that this place represents them and that this place feels home and it tells their story, I think we give an opportunity for people, we give what we can as a museum, but I think we're much bigger than a museum, but I think we give what we can to the people to continue to be Jewish, to continue to fulfill their life in the Jewish way, in whatever way they believe it's right. But I think that seeing yourself at home, feeling yourself part of something is what gives you a lot of energy to keep going.
Passover's just about to start. You've got all your friends and relatives from all over the world, different languages, all assembled. There's a knock on the door and your guest from Jewish history, past or present, has arrived on the doorstep. When you open the door, who's there?
Theodor Herzl. You would guess, right? You know, I have a friend who says that my boyfriend's name is Theo. That's how much I talk about him.
So apart from the obvious, I suppose, what is it about Theodor Herzl that you admire so much?
It's very obvious and it's very banal, and yet it's very touching and very personal for me. We've just talked about the vision, and there is a person who at a very early age had a vision, could formulate it, which is amazing because that's one of the problems. People have all sorts of fantasies, which they call vision, could formulate that, but also could formulate a very pragmatic plan as to how you go about it. It doesn't really matter if the plan was right or not. It's the fact that he combined these two qualities together, which is one, having a vision, and, you know, B'Shana Abba B'Yerushalayim, it's a very big vision, very well said, right? And then also having the guts and having the wisdom to provide a roadmap for that. I mean, the result is obvious. The result, we have the state of Israel. So many, many years, hundreds of years after he imagined that. So I think the ability to meet a person who combines those two qualities, which is combining the almost fantasy, a dream, and making it a reality, that's what makes him so fascinating for me.
It's easy to forget in the context of the current state of Israel existing that it really was a fantasy.
Absolutely. It was a fantasy. It only takes a person with a heart and guts to take the fantasy and decide that it's going to be his reality, and then to spend, you know, lifetime, short lifetime, unfortunately, doing that. But that's why I think he gives me hope. I'm very optimistic by nature. That's who I am. But I know that it's possible. I know that it's doable. I know that it's possible to have a dream, to unite around the dream, and to actually execute it, not to stay in the realm of dreams, which happens a lot of times with people. So he gives me hope.
So you're sitting next to Theodor Herzl and you're halfway through your Seder service. Maybe you've had a couple of glasses of wine already. What would you ask him?
I would ask him, what's the second volume? What is Herzl volume 2? What does he see for the country that he created for us?
Now, if you had the ability to be able to take Herzl through the new Anu, what would you be most proud of showing him?
I think that the most, I will say two things, and it's only two things that I can say this week. So one thing will be the third floor, where every Jewish person is represented, but everybody can find themselves, whether they live in Israel or not. He'll be fascinating to find out that half of the people lives in Israel and half not, and that's what I think should make us stronger, right? So I think the third floor, where everyone is represented and everyone can see themselves and hear themselves. And this week, especially because we have for a week with us the Codex Sasson, which is the oldest Tanakh and the most full Tanakh in the world of the 10th century. We have it in the museum. I think I'll be pretty happy to show that to him, because there is something which are some things which are forever, whether you are interested in history or not, whether you like the text or not, whether you're religious or not, doesn't matter. Actually, whether you're Jewish or not, there are some texts which are global and forever. And I'm very happy that we have an opportunity to represent it at Anu.
And I have to say, I'm deeply disappointed that I won't be in Israel to be able to see it. I think it's quite extraordinary.
It's very to be able to reach my Israel in the something where, and mind you, I'm the Ole Chadash, many years still, but Ole Chadash, where you can read in easy Hebrew, Shema Israel, and you can see the page fully. It's touching, even for the most cynical of us.
Finally, Arina, I can't sort of leave without asking you, what do you think the future of a physical museum is in this digital age?
Look, I think that like many, there is a name, right, museum, which sometimes rings old for people and like, and then there is what it is in reality. I think if the museums were to choose to stay only the museum in the traditional way of that we remember that, which is showing the past, I think that the museums will be in trouble. But people are searching for experience. People are searching for engagement. People are searching for belonging. So I think as long as any organization, especially museum, knows what story it wants to tell and pass on and uses all the available techniques and doesn't become too elitistic about whether it has to be only artifacts or only technology, because the truth of the matter is everybody is touched by different things. What you will enjoy the most in the museum, what I will enjoy, what anybody else on Theodor Herzl would enjoy, and who will be touched by what, you don't really know. There are so many options. So I think as long as the museums remember that they shouldn't be elitist, and they have been elitist for a very long time, as long as they understand that mass market is not a bad word, and they understand that they have to use all that the world has to offer, and they know what their story is, that's the critical, right? That know what their DNA, what their story is, what their identity is. I think the museums will be fine. I can say that proudly from the Anu experience, you can be fine.
Well, Irina, thank you very much indeed. If you do manage to speak to Herzl during your Seder this year, please do come back and let us know what the second volume is. Irina, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you, David. Chag Sameach.
Thank you very much for listening to this podcast, an Anu community project. The home Seder service has been an integral part of Jewish community and Jewish family life. To find out more about this series and listen to other interviews, just go to mysederguest.com. To explore Anu, go to anumuseum.org.il. Thank you to all of our guests for sharing their stories and being so generous with their time.